but the fierce throbbing was down to a dull ache. She had felt worse as a teenager, after spending a long hot day in a bra that was too small for her. From where she knelt, chin deep in the water, she could see that the moon, now smaller and almost pure silver, had risen above all but the highest of the trees in the graveyard. And now a new fear rose to trouble her. What if the long boy came back? What if it heard her thinking about it and came back? This was supposed to be a safe place, and Lisi thought it probably was. From the laughers and the other nasty things that might live in the fairy forest, at least. But she had an idea that the long boy might not be bound by any rules that held the other things away from here. She had an idea the long boy was different. The title of some old horror story first occurred to her, then clanged in her mind like an iron bell. Oh, whistle, and I'll come to you, my lad. This was followed by the title of the only Scott Landon book she had ever hated, Empty Devils. But before she could start back to the sand, before she could even get to her feet again, Lisi was struck by yet another memory, this one far more recent. It was of waking in bed with her sister Amanda just before dawn, and finding that past and present had gotten all tangled together. Worse still, Lisi had come to believe that she wasn't in bed with her sister at all, but with her dead husband. And in a way, that had been true. Because although the thing in bed with her had been wearing Manda's nightgown and had spoken in Manda's voice, it had used the interior language of their marriage and phrases only Scott could have known. "You have a blood pool coming," the thing in bed with her had said, and along had come the Black Prince of the Inkunks, with her own OXO can opener in his nasty bag of tricks. "It goes behind the purple. You've already found the first three stations. A few more, and you'll get your prize." And what prize had the thing in bed with her promised? A drink. She had guessed a Coke or an RC Cola because those had been Paul's prizes. But now she knew better. Lisi lowered her head, buried her battered face in the pool, and then, without allowing herself to think about what she was doing, took two quick swallows. The water in which she stood was almost hot, but what she took in her mouth was cool and sweet and refreshing. She could have drunk a good deal more, but some intuition told her to stop at two sips. Two was just the right number. She touched her lips and found that the swelling there was almost gone. She wasn't surprised. Not trying to be quiet, and not bothering to be grateful, at least not yet, Lisi floundered back to the beach. It seemed to take forever. No one was waiting near shore now, and the beach was empty. Lisi thought she saw the woman she'd spoken to sitting on one of the stone benches with her companion, but couldn't be sure because the moon hadn't risen quite enough. She looked a bit higher, and her gaze fixed on one of the rapt figures a dozen or so benches up from the water. Moonlight had coated one side of this creature's gauzy head with thin silver gilt, and a queer certainty came to her. That was Scott, and he was watching her. Didn't the idea make a kind of crazy sense? Didn't it? If he had held on to enough consciousness and will to come to her in the moments before dawn, as she lay in bed with her catatonic sister? Didn't it? If he was determined to have his say just one more time? She felt the urge to call his name, even though to do so would surely be dangerous madness. She opened her mouth, and water from her wet hair ran into her eyes, stinging them. Faintly, she heard the wind tinkling Chuck E. Cheese's bell. It was then that Scott spoke to her, and for the last time. "Lisi." Infinitely tender, that voice, calling her name, calling her home. Little. 15. "Lisi," he says. "Baby love." He's in the rocking chair, and she's sitting on the cold floor, but he's the one doing the shivering. Lisi has a sudden brilliant memory of Granny Dee saying, "Afeard and shivering in the dark." And it hits her that he's cold because now all of the African is in Buya Moon. But that's not all. The whole frigging room is cold. It was chilly before, but now it's cold, and the lights are out as well. The constant, whooshy whisper of the furnace has ceased, and when she looks out of the frosty window, she can see only the extravagant colors of the northern lights. The Galloway's pole light next door has gone dark. Power outage, she thinks, but no, the television is still on, and that damned movie is still playing. The boys from Anarene, Texas, are hanging out in the pool hall. Soon they'll go to Mexico, and when they come back, Sam the Lion will be dead. He'll be wrapped in gauze and sitting on one of those stone benches overlooking the... That's not right, Scott says. His teeth are chattering slightly, but she can still hear the perplexity in his voice. I never turned the goddamn movie on, because I thought it would wake you up, Lisi. Also, she knows that's true. When she came in here this time and found him, the TV was off. But right now, she's got something far more important on her mind. Scott, will it follow us? No, baby, he says. It can't do that unless it gets a real good whiff of your scent. Or a fix on your... He trails off. It's the movie he's still most concerned with, it seems. Also, it's never jambalaya in this scene. I've watched The Last Picture Show 50 times. Except for Citizen Kane, it may be the greatest movie ever made, and it's never jambalaya in the pool hall scene. It's Hank Williams, sure, but it's Kalijah, the song about the Indian chief. And if the TV and the VCR are working, where's the damn lights? He gets up and flicks the wall switch. There's nothing. That big cold wind from Yellowknife has finally killed their power, and power all over Castle Rock, Castle View, Harlow, Motton, Tashmore Pond, and most of western Maine. At the same instant Scott flicks the useless light switch on, the TV goes off. The picture dwindles to a bright white spot that glows for a moment, then disappears. The next time he tries his tape of The Last Picture Show, he'll discover a 10-minute stretch in the middle of it is blank, as if wiped clean by a powerful magnetic field. Neither of them will ever speak of it, but Scott and Lisi will understand that although both of them were visualizing the guest room, it was probably Lisi who hollered them home with the greatest force. And it was certainly Lisi who visualized old Hank singing Jambalaya instead of Kalijah. And it was Lisi who so fiercely visualized both the VCR and the TV running when they returned that those appliances did run for almost a minute and a half, even though the electricity was out from one end of Castle County to the other. He stokes up the wood stove in the kitchen with oak chunks from the wood box, and she makes them a jackleg bed, blankets and an air mattress, on the linoleum. When they lie down, he takes her in his arms. I'm afraid to go to sleep, she confesses. I'm afraid that when I wake up in the morning, the stove will be out and you'll be gone again. He shakes his head. I'm all right. It's passed for a while. She looks at him with hope and doubt. Is that something you know or just something you're saying to soothe the little wife? Which do you think? She thinks this isn't the ghost Scott she's been living with since November, but it's still hard for her to believe in such miraculous changes. You seem better, but I'm leery of my own wishful thinking. In the stove, a knot of wood explodes and she jumps. He holds her closer. She snuggles against him almost fiercely. It's warm under the covers, warm in his arms. He is all she has ever wanted in the dark. He says, This thing that has troubled my family. It comes and goes. When it passes, it's like a cramp letting go. But will it come back? Lisi, it might not. The strength and surety in his voice so surprises her that she looks up to check his face. She sees no duplicity there, even of the kindly sort meant to ease a troubled wife's heart. And if it does, it might never come back as strongly as it did this time. Did your father tell you that? My father didn't know much about the gone part. I've felt this tug toward the place where you found me twice before. Once the year before I met you. That time booze and rock music got me through, The second time... Germany, she says flatly. Yes, he says, Germany. That time you pulled me through, Lisi. How close, Scott? How close was it in Bremen? Close, he says simply, and it makes her cold. If she had lost him in Germany, she would have lost him for good. Mein Gott. But that was a breeze compared to this. This was a hurricane. There are other things she wants to ask him, but mostly she wants to hold him and believe him when he says that maybe things will be okay. The way you want to believe the doctor, she supposes, when he says that the cancer is in remission and may never come back. And you're okay. She needs to hear him say it one more time. Needs to. Yes. Good to go, as the saying is. And it? She doesn't need to be more specific. Scott knows what she's talking about. It's had my scent for a long time, and it knows the shape of my thoughts. After all these years, we're practically old friends. It could probably take me if it wanted to, but it would be an effort, and that fella's pretty lazy. Also, something watches out for me. Something on the bright side of the equation. There is a bright side, you know. You must know, because you're a part of it. Once you told me you could call it if you wanted to. She says this very low. Yes. And sometimes you want to, don't you? He doesn't deny it, and outside the wind howls a long, cold note along the eaves. Yet here under the blankets in front of the kitchen stove, it's warm. It's warm with him. Stay with me, Scott, she says. I will, he tells her. I will, as long as... 16. I will as long as I can, Lisi said. She realized several things at the same time. One was that she had returned to her bedroom and her bed. Another was that the bed would have to be changed, because she had come back soaking wet and her damp feet were coated with beach sand from another world. A third was that she was shivering even though the room wasn't particularly cold. A fourth was that she no longer had the silver spade. She had left it behind. The last was that if the seated shape had indeed been her husband, she had almost certainly seen him for the last time. Her husband was now one of the shrouded things, an unburied corpse. Lying on her wet bed in her soaking shorts, Lisi burst into tears. She had a great deal to do now, and she had come back with most of the steps clear in her mind. She thought that might also have been part of her prize at the end of Scott's last bull hunt. But first, she needed to finish grieving for her husband. She put an arm over her eyes and lay so for the next 5 minutes, sobbing until her eyes were swollen nearly shut and her throat ached. She had never thought she would want him so much or miss him so badly. It was a shock. Yet at the same time, and although there was also still some pain in her damaged breast, Lisi thought she had never felt so well, so glad to be alive, or so ready to kick ass and take down names, as the saying was. Chapter 12. Lisi at Greenlawn. The Hollyhocks. 1. She glanced at the clock on the nightstand as she peeled off her soaked shorts and smiled, not because there was anything intrinsically funny about 10 minutes to 12 on a morning in June, but because one of Scrooge's lines from A Christmas Carol had occurred to her. The spirits have done it all in one night. It seemed to Lisi that something had accomplished a great deal in her own life in a very short period of time, most of it in the last few hours. But you have to remember that I've been living in the past, and that takes up a surprising amount of a person's time, she thought. And after a moment's consideration let out a great, larruping laugh that probably would have sounded insane to anyone listening down the hall. That's okay. Keep laughing, baby love. Ain't nobody here but us chickadees, she thought, going into the bathroom. That big, loose laugh started to come out of her again, then stopped suddenly when it occurred to her that Dooley might be here. He could be holed up in the root cellar, or one of this big house's many closets. He might be sweating it out this late morning in the attic, right over her head. She didn't know much about him and would be the first to admit it, but the idea that he had gone to ground here in the house fit what she did know. He'd already proved he was a bold son of a bitch. Don't worry about him now. Worry about Darla and Canty. Good idea. Lisi could get to Greenlawn ahead of her older sisters. That wouldn't be much of a horse race, but she couldn't afford to dawdle either. Keep your string a-drawing, she thought. But she couldn't deny herself a moment in front of the full-length mirror on the back of her bedroom door, standing with her hands at her sides, looking levelly and without prejudice at her slender, unremarkable, middle-aged body, and at her face, which Scott had once described as that of a fox in summer. It was a little puffy, nothing more. She looked like she'd slept exceptionally hard, maybe after a drink or three too many, and her lips still turned out a little, giving them a strangely sensual quality that made her feel both uneasy and a tiny bit gleeful. She hesitated, not sure what to do about that, and then found a tube of Revlon Hothouse Pink at the back of her lipstick drawer. She touched some on and nodded a little doubtfully. If people were going to look at her lips, and she thought they might, she'd do better giving them something to look at than trying to cover up what couldn't be hidden. The breast Dooley had operated on with such lunatic absorption was marked with an ugly scarlet ditch that circled up from beneath her armpit before petering out above her ribcage. It looked like a fairly bad cut that might have happened 2 or 3 weeks ago, and was now healing well. The two shallower wounds looked like no more than the sort of red marks that resulted from wearing too tight elastic garments. Or perhaps, if you had a lively imagination, rope burns. The difference between this and the horror she had observed upon regaining consciousness was amazing. All the Landons are fast healers, you son of a bitch, Lisi said, and stepped into the shower. 2. A quick rinse was all she had time for, and her breast was still sore enough to make her decide against a bra. She put on a pair of carpenter's pants and a loose t-shirt. She slipped a vest over the latter to keep anyone from staring at her nipples, assuming guys bothered scoping out the nipples of 50-year-old women, that was. According to Scott, they did. She remembered his telling her, once upon a happier time, that straight men stared at pretty much anyone of a female persuasion between the ages of roughly 14 and 84. He claimed it was a simple hardwired circuit between eye and cock, that the brain had nothing to do with it. It was noon. She went downstairs, glanced into the living room, and saw the remaining pack of cigarettes sitting on the coffee table. She had no craving for cigarettes now. She got a fresh jar of Skippy out of the pantry instead, steeling herself for Jim Dooley lurking in the corner or behind the pantry door. And the strawberry jam out of the fridge. She made herself a PB&J on white and took 2 delicious gummy bites before calling Professor Woodbody. The Castle County Sheriff's Department had taken Zach McCool's threatening letter, but Lisi's memory for numbers had always been good, and this one was a cinch. Pittsburgh area code at one end, 81 and 88 at the other. She was as willing to talk to the queen of the Inkunks as the king. An answering machine, however, would be inconvenient. She could leave her message, but would have no way of being sure it would reach the right ear in time to do any good. She need not have worried. Woodbody himself answered, and he did not sound kingly. He sounded chastened and cautious. Yes, hello? Hello, Professor Woodbody. This is Lisa Landon. I don't want to talk to you. I've spoken to my lawyer, and he says I don't have to. Chill, she said, and eyed her sandwich with longing. It wouldn't do to talk with her mouth full. On the upside, she thought this conversation was going to be brief. I'm not going to make any trouble for you. No trouble with the cops, no trouble with lawyers, nothing like that. If you do me one teensy favor. What favor? Woodbody sounded suspicious. Lisi couldn't blame him for that. There's an off chance your friend Jim Dooley may call you today.
That guy's no friend of mine, Woodbody bleated.
Right, Lisi thought, and you're well on your way to persuading yourself he never was.
Okay, drinking buddy, passing acquaintance, whatever. If he calls, just tell him I've changed my mind. Would you do that?
Say I've regained my senses.
Tell him I'll see him this evening at 8 in my husband's study.
You sound like someone preparing to get herself into a great deal of trouble, Mrs. Landon.
Hey, you'd know, wouldn't you?
The sandwich was looking better and better. Lisi's stomach rumbled.
Professor, he probably won't call you, in which case you're golden. If he does call, give him my message and you're also golden.
But if he calls and you don't give him my message, just she's changed her mind, she wants to see you tonight in Scott's study at 8, and I find out, then, sir, oy, such a mess I'm making for you.
You can't. My lawyer says...
Don't listen to what he says. Be smart, and listen to what I'm saying.
My husband left me $20 million. With that kind of money, if I decide to ass fuck you, you'll spend the next 3 years shitting blood from a crouch. Got it?
Lisi hung up before he could say anything else, tore a bite from her sandwich, got the lime Kool-Aid from the fridge, thought about a glass, then drank directly from the pitcher instead.
Yum.
3. If Dooley phoned during the next few hours, she wouldn't be around to take his call. Luckily, Lisi knew which phone he'd ring in on. She went out to her unfinished office in the barn, across from the shrouded corpse of the Bremen bed. She sat in the plain kitchen-style chair. A nice new desk chair was one of the things she'd never gotten around to ordering. Pushed the record message button on the answering machine, and spoke without thinking too much. She hadn't come back from Booyah Moon with a plan so much as with a clear set of steps to follow, and the belief that, if she did her part, Jim Dooley would be forced to do his.
"I'll whistle and you'll come to me, my lad," she thought.
"Zack, Mr. Dooley, this is Lisi. If you're hearing this, I'm visiting my sister who's in the hospital up in Auburn. I spoke to the prof, and I'm so grateful this is going to work out. I'll be in my husband's study tonight at 8, or you can call me here at 7 and arrange something else if you're worried about the police. There may be a sheriff's deputy parked out front, maybe even in the bushes across the road, so be careful. I'll listen for messages." She was afraid that might be too much for the outgoing message tape to handle, but it wasn't. And what would Jim Dooley make of it if he called this number and heard it? Given his current level of craziness, Lisi couldn't begin to predict. Would he break radio silence and call the professor in Pittsburgh? He might. Whether or not the professor would actually pass on her message if Dooley did was also impossible to predict, and maybe it didn't matter. She didn't much care if Dooley thought she was actually ready to deal or just jacking him around. She only wanted him nervous and curious, the way she imagined a fish felt when it was looking up at a lure skipping along the surface of a lake. She didn't dare leave a note on her door. It was all too likely Deputy Beckman or Deputy Alston would read it long before Dooley had a chance to, and that was probably taking things a step too far anyway. For the time being, she had done all she could.
"And do you really expect him to show up at 8 o'clock tonight, Lisi? To just come waltzing up the stairs to Scott's office, full of trust and belief?"
She didn't expect him to come waltzing, and she didn't expect him to be full of anything but the lunacy she had already experienced. But she did expect him to come. He would be as careful as any feral thing, casting about for a trap or a setup, possibly sneaking in from the woods as early as mid-afternoon. But Lisi believed he would know in his heart that this wasn't some trick that she'd worked out with the sheriff's department or the state police. He'd know from the eagerness to please he heard in her voice. And because after what he'd done to her, he had every reason to expect her to be one cowed cow. She played the message back twice and nodded.
Yeah.
On the surface, she sounded like a woman who was merely eager to finish some troublesome piece of business, but she thought Dooley would hear the fright and pain just beneath. Because he expected to hear them, and because he was crazy. Lisi thought there was something else at work here as well. She had gotten her drink. She had gotten her bool. and it had made her strong in some primal way. It might not last long, but that didn't matter, because a little of that strength, a little of that primal weirdness, was now on the answering machine tape. She thought that if Dooley called, he would hear it and respond to it. 4. Her cell phone was still in the BMW, and now fully charged. She thought of going back to the little office in the barn and redoing the message on the answering machine, adding the mobile number, then realized she didn't know it. "I so rarely call myself, darling," she thought, and unloosed that big, larruping laugh again. She drove slowly out to the end of the driveway, hoping that Deputy Alston would be there. He was, looking bigger than ever and rather primal himself. Lisi got out of her car and gave him a little salute. He did not call for backup or run screaming from the sight of her face. He merely grinned and tipped the salute right back at her. It had certainly crossed Lisi's mind to spin a tale if she found a deputy on duty. Something about Zach McCool calling her up and telling her he'd decided to get his little old self back to his little old holler in West Virginia and forget all about the writer's widder woman. Just too many Yankee police around. She'd do it without the Deliverance accent, of course, and she thought she could be fairly convincing, especially in her current state of baptismal grace. But in the end, she had decided against it. Such a story might end up putting acting Sheriff Clusterfuck and his deputies even more on their guard. They might think Jim Dooley was trying to lull them to sleep. No, much better to leave matters as they were. Dooley had found his way to her once. He could probably do it again. If they caught him, her problems would be solved, although in truth, seeing Jim Dooley caught was no longer her solution of choice. In any case, she didn't like the idea of lying to either Alston or Beckman any more than she had to. They were cops. They were doing their best to protect her. And on top of that, they were a couple of likable lummoxes.
"How's it going, Mrs. Landon?"
"Fine. I just stopped to tell you I'm going up to Auburn. My sister's in the hospital up there."
"I'm very sorry to hear that. CMG or Kingdom?"
"Greenlawn." She wasn't sure he'd know it, but from the little wince that tightened his face, she guessed that he did.
"Well, that's too bad. But at least it's a pretty day for a drive. You just want to get back before late afternoon. Radio says there's gonna be big thunderstorms, especially here in the Western."
Lisi looked around and smiled, first at the day, which was indeed summery gorgeous, at least so far, and then at Deputy Alston. "I'll do my best. Thanks for the heads up."
"Not a problem."
"Say, the side of your nose looks kind of swelled. Did something bite you?"
"Mosquitoes do that to me sometimes," Lisi said. "There's one beside my lip, too. Can you see it?" Alston peered at her mouth, which Dooley had beaten back and forth with his open hand not long ago.
"Nope. Can't say that I do."
"Good, the Benadryl must be working, as long as it doesn't make me sleepy."
"If it does, pull over, okay? Do yourself a favor."
"Yes, Dad," Lisi said, and Alston laughed. He also blushed a little.
"By the way, Mrs. Landon?"
"Lisi."
"Yes, ma'am, Lisi. Andy called. He'd like you to drop by the sheriff's office when it's convenient and make an official report on this business. You know, something you can sign for the record. Would you do that?"
"Yes, I'll try to stop in on my way back from Auburn."
"Well, I'll tell you a little secret, Mrs. Lisi. Both our secretaries are apt to clear out early on days when it comes on to hard rain. They live out in Mountain Way, and those roads flood if you look at them cross-eyed. Need new culverts."
Lisi shrugged. "We'll see," she said. She made a show of looking at her watch. "Whoa, look at the time. I really have to run. Help yourself to the toilet if you have to, Deputy Alston. There's..."
"Joe. If you're Lisi, I'm Joe."
She gave him a thumbs up. "Okay, Joe. There's a key to the back door under the porch step. If you feel around a little, I think you'll find it."
"Yeah, I'm a trained investigator,"
he said with a straight face. Lisi burst out laughing and held up her hand. Deputy Joe Alston, now grinning himself, high-fived her there in the sunshine near the mailbox, where she'd found the dead Galloway barn cat. 5. Driving to Auburn, she mused for a little while on how Deputy Joe Alston had looked at her as they stood talking at the end of the driveway. It had been a long while since she'd attracted a honey-you-look-so-good stare from a man, but she'd gotten one today, slightly swollen nose and all. Amazing. Amazing. The get-beat-up-by-Jim-Dooley beauty treatment, she said and laughed. I could hawk it on high-channel cable TV. And her mouth had the most wonderfully sweet taste. If she ever wanted another cigarette, she would be surprised. Maybe she could hawk that on high-channel cable, too. 6. By the time Lisi got to Greenlawn, it was 1:20. She didn't expect to see Darla's car, but still let out a sigh of relief when she had made sure it wasn't one of the dozen or so scattered around the visitor's parking lot. She liked the idea of Darla and Canty well south of here, well away from the dangerous craziness of Jim Dooley. She remembered helping Mr. Silver grade potatoes when she was a little girl, well, 12 or 13, not so little at that, and how he'd always cautioned her to wear pants and keep her sleeves rolled up when she was around the potato grater in the back shed. You get caught in that baby, she'll undress you, he'd said. And she had taken the warning to heart, because she understood old Max Silver hadn't been talking about what his hulk of a potato grater would do to her clothes, but what it would do to her. Amanda was part of this, had been since the day she'd shown up as Lisi was half-heartedly beginning the job of cleaning out Scott's study. Lisi accepted that. Darla and Canty, however, would be an unnecessary complication. If God was good, he would keep them at the snow squall, eating lazy lobster and drinking white wine spritzers for a long time. Like until midnight. Before she got out of her car, Lisi touched her left breast lightly with her right hand, wincing in advance at the bright lance of pain she expected. All she felt was a faint throb. Amazing, she thought. It's like touching a week-old bruise. Anytime you get to doubting the reality of Booyah Moon, Lisi, just remember what he did to your breast, not even 5 hours ago, and what it feels like now. She got out of the car, locked it with the smart key, then paused for a moment to look around, trying to fix the spot in her mind. She had no clear reason for doing this. Nothing she could have put her finger on, even if she'd wanted to. It was just more of that step-by-step thing, almost like baking bread for the first time from a cookbook recipe, and that was fine by her. Freshly tarred and lined, the Green Lawn visitor's parking lot reminded her strongly of the parking lot where her husband had fallen 18 years ago, and she heard the ghostly voice of Assistant Professor Roger Dashmeal, a.k.a. the Southern Fried Chicken Shit, saying, "We'll proceed on across yonder parking lot to Nelson Hall, which is mercifully air-conditioned." No Nelson Hall here. Nelson Hall was in the land of ago, as was the man who had gone there to dig a spadeful of earth and inaugurate construction of the Shipman Library. What she saw looming over the neatly trimmed hedges wasn't an English department building, but the smooth brick and bright glass of a 21st-century madhouse, the sort of clean, well-lighted place where her husband might well have finished up if something, some spore the doctors in Bowling Green had eventually elected to call pneumonia. No one wanted to put unknown causes on the death certificate of a man whose demise would be reported on the front page of the New York Times. Had not finished him first. On this side of the hedge was an oak tree. Lisi had parked so that the BMW would be in its shade, although, yes, she could see clouds massing in the west, so maybe Deputy Joe Alston was right about those afternoon thunderstorms. The tree would make a perfectly lovely marker if it had been the only one, but it wasn't. There was a whole row of them along the hedge. To Lisi, they all looked the same. And what the smuck did it matter anyway? She started for the path to the main building, but something inside, a voice that didn't seem like any of the variations of her own mental voice, nagged her back, insisting that she look at her car and its place in the parking lot again. She wondered if something wanted her to move the BMW to a different spot. If so, it wasn't making its wants known very clearly. Lisi settled for a walk around instead, as her father had told her you should always do before setting out on a long trip.
Only then you were looking for uneven tire wear, a busted taillight, a sagging muffler, things of that sort. Now she didn't know what she was looking for. Maybe I'm just putting off seeing her. Maybe that's all it is. But it wasn't. It was more. And it was important. She observed her license plate. 576-1RD, with that stupid loon, and a very faded bumper sticker, a joke gift from Jody. It read, "Jesus loves me, this I know, that is why I don't drive slow." Nothing else. Not good enough, the voice nagged, and then she spied something interesting in the far corner of the parking lot, almost beneath the hedge. An empty green bottle. A beer bottle, she was almost sure. Either the maintenance crew had missed it or hadn't gotten to it yet. Lisi hurried over and picked it up, getting a certain sour agricultural whiff from the neck of the thing. On the label, slightly faded, was a snarling canine. According to the label, this bottle had once held Nordic Wolf premium beer. Lisi brought the bottle back to her car and set it on the pavement directly beneath the loon on her license plate. Cream-colored BMW, not good enough. Cream-colored BMW sitting in the shadow of an oak tree, still not good enough. Cream-colored BMW sitting in the shadow of an oak tree with an empty Nordic Wolf beer bottle under main loon license plate 576-1RD and slightly to the left of the joke bumper sticker. Good enough. Just barely. And why? Lisi didn't give a sweet smuck. She hurried for the main building. 7. There was no trouble getting in to see Amanda, even though afternoon visiting hours did not officially commence until 2, which was still half an hour away. Thanks to Dr. Hugh Albernez, and Scott, of course, Lisi was something of a star at Greenlawn. 10 minutes after giving her name at the main desk, dwarfed by a gigantic new-agey mural of children with linked hands staring raptly up into the night sky, Lisi was sitting with her sister on the little patio outside Amanda's room, sipping lackluster punch from a Dixie cup, and watching a game of croquet on the rolling back lawn for which the place had no doubt been named. Somewhere out of sight, a power mower blatted monotonously. The duty nurse had asked Amanda if she wouldn't also like a cup of bug juice, and took Amanda's silence for consent. It now sat untouched beside her on the table while Amanda, dressed in a mint-green pajama set and with a matching ribbon in her freshly washed hair, looked blankly off into the distance, not at the croquet players, Lisi thought, but through them. Her hands were clasped in her lap, but Lisi could see the ugly cut that looped around the left one, and the gleam of fresh salve. Lisi had tried 3 different conversation openers, and Amanda had not uttered so much as a single word in response, which, according to the nurse, was par for the course. Amanda was currently incommunicado, not taking messages, out to lunch, on vacation, visiting the asteroid belt. All her life she had been troublesome, but this was a new high even for her. And Lisi, who was expecting company in her husband's study only 6 hours from now, didn't have time for it. She took a sip of her largely flavorless drink, wished for a Coke, verboten here because of the caffeine, and set it aside. She looked around to make sure they were alone, then leaned forward and plucked Amanda's hands out of her lap, trying not to wince at the slimy feel of the salve and the lumpy lines of the healing slashes just beneath. If it hurt Amanda to be held so, she didn't show it. Her face remained a smooth blank, as if she were sleeping with her eyes open. "Amanda," Lisi said. She tried to make eye contact with her sister, but it was impossible. "Amanda, listen to me now. You wanted to help me clean up what Scott left behind, and I need you to help me do that. I need your help." No answer. "There's a bad man, a crazy man. He's a little like that son of a bitch Cole in Nashville, a lot like him, actually. Only I can't take care of this one on my own. You have to come back from wherever you are and help me." No answer. Amanda stared out at the croquet players, through the croquet players. The power mower blatted. The paper cups of bug juice sat on the patio table that had no corners,
In this place, corners were as verboten as caffeine. Do you know what I think, Manda Bunny? I think you're sitting on one of those stone benches with the rest of the gorked-out goners, staring at the pool. I think Scott saw you there on one of his visits, and said to himself, "Oh, a cutter. I recognize cutters when I see him because my dad was a member of the tribe. Hell, I'm a member of the tribe." He said to himself, "There's a lady who's going to take early retirement here, unless somebody puts a spoke in her wheel, so to speak." Does that sound about right, Manda? Nothing. I don't know if he foresaw Jim Dooley, but he foresaw you ending up at Greenlawn, just as sure as shite sticks to a blanket. Do you remember how Dandy used to say that sometimes, Manda? Just as sure as shite sticks to a blanket? And when Good Ma yelled at him, he said shite was like drat. Shite wasn't swearing, do you remember? More nothing from Amanda, just a vacant, maddening gape. Lisey thought of that cold night with Scott in the guest room, when the wind thundered and the sky burned, and put her mouth close to Amanda's ear. "If you can hear me, squeeze my hands," she whispered. "Squeeze just as hard as you can." She waited, and the seconds passed. She had almost given up when there came the faintest twitch. It could have been an involuntary muscle spasm or just imagination, but Lisey didn't think so. She thought that somewhere far away, Amanda heard her sister hollering her name, hollering her home. "All right," Lisey said. Her heart was pounding so hard she felt it might choke her. "That's good. That's a start. I'm going to come get you, Amanda. I'm going to bring you home, and you're going to help me. Do you hear? You have to help me." Lisey closed her eyes and once more tightened her grip on Amanda's hands, knowing she might be hurting her sister, not caring. Amanda could complain later when she had a voice to complain with, if she had a voice to complain with. Ah, but the world was made of if, Scott had told her that once. Lisey summoned her will and concentration, and created the clearest version of the pool she could, seeing the rocky cup in which it lay, seeing the clean white arrowhead of beach with the stone benches stepped above it in mild curves, seeing the break in the rock, and the secondary path, something like a throat that led to the graveyard. She made the water a brilliant blue, sparkling with thousands of sun points. She made it the pool at midday, because she'd had her fill of Booyah Moon at dusk, thank you very much. "Now," she thought, and waited for the air to turn and the sounds of Greenlawn to fade. For a moment she thought those sounds did fade, then decided that really was her imagination. She opened her eyes and the patio was still ratcheer, with Amanda's cup of bug juice on the round table. Amanda remained in her deep catatonic placidity, so much breathing wax within her mint-green pajamas, which closed with Velcro because buttons could be swallowed. Amanda with the matching green ribbon in her hair, and the oceans in her eyes. For a moment, Lisey was assailed with terrible doubt. Perhaps the whole thing had been nothing but her madness. All except for Jim Dooley, that was. There were no screwed-up families like the Landons outside of V.C. Andrews' novels. No places like Booyah Moon outside of children's fantasy tales. She had been married to a writer who died, that was all. She had saved him once, but when he got sick in Kentucky 8 years later, there had been nothing she could do. Because you couldn't swat a microbe with a shovel, could you? She began to relax her hold on Amanda's hands, then tightened it again. Every bit of her strong heart and considerable will rose up in protest. No, it was real. Booyah Moon is real. I was there in 1979 before I married him. I went there again in 1996 to find him when he needed finding, to bring him home when he needed bringing, and I was there again this morning. All I have to do is compare how my breast felt after Jim Dooley finished with it to what it feels like now, if I start to doubt. The reason I can't go... "The African," she murmured. "He said the African was holding us there like an anchor. He didn't know why." "Are you holding us here, Manda? Is some scared, stubborn part of you holding us here? Holding me here?" Amanda didn't answer, but Lisey thought that was exactly what was happening.
Part of Amanda wanted Lisi to come get her and bring her back, but there was another part that wanted no rescue. That part really did want to be done with all the dirty world and the dirty world's problems. That part would be more than happy to continue taking lunch through a tube and shooting poop into a diaper and spending warm afternoons out here on the little patio, wearing pajamas with Velcro closures, staring at the green lawns and the croquet players. And what was Amanda really looking at? The pool. The pool in the morning, the pool in the afternoon, the pool at sunset and glimmering by starshine and moonlight, with little trails of vapor rising from its surface like dreams of amnesia. Lisi realized her mouth still tasted sweet, as it usually did only first thing in the morning, and thought, "That's from the pool. My prize. My drink. 2 sips. One for me, and one..." "One for you," she said. All at once, the next step was so beautifully clear that she wondered why she had wasted so much time. Still holding Amanda by the hands, Lisi leaned forward so that her face was in front of her sister's. Amanda's eyes remained unfocused and far-seeing beneath her straight-cut, graying bangs, as if she were looking right through Lisi. Only when Lisi slid her arms up to Amanda's elbows, first pinning her in place and then putting her mouth against her sister's mouth, did Amanda's eyes widen in belated understanding. Only then did Amanda struggle, and by then it was too late. Lisi's mouth flooded with sweetness as her last sip from the pool reversed itself. She used her tongue to force Amanda's lips open, and as she felt the second mouthful of water she had drunk from the pool flow from her mouth to her sister's, Lisi saw the pool with a perfect daytime clarity that beggared her previous efforts at concentration and visualization, fierce and driven though they had been. She could smell frangipani and bougainvillea, mingled with the deep and somehow sorrowful olive smell that she knew was the daytime aroma of the sweetheart trees. She could feel the packed hot sand beneath her feet, her bare feet, because her sneakers hadn't traveled. Her sneakers hadn't, but she had. She had made it. She had gotten over. She was... 8. She was back in Buya Moon, standing on the warm, packed sand of the beach, this time with the bright sun beating down overhead and making not thousands of points of light on the water, but what seemed like millions. Because this water was wider. For a moment, Lisi looked at it, fascinated, and at the great old hulk of a sailing ship that floated there. And as she looked at it, she suddenly understood something the revenant in Amanda's bed had told her. "What's my prize?" Lisi had asked, and the thing, which had somehow seemed to be both Scott and Amanda at the same time, had told her that her prize would be a drink. But when Lisi asked if that meant a Coke or an RC, the thing had said, "Be quiet. We want to watch the hollyhocks." Lisi had assumed the thing was talking about flowers. She had forgotten that there had been a very different meaning for that word once upon a time, a magical one. That ship out there in all that blue and shining water was what Amanda had meant. For that had been Amanda. Scott would almost surely not have known about that wonderful childhood dreamboat. This was no pool she was looking at. This was a harbor where only one ship rode at anchor, a ship made for brave pirate girls who dared to go seeking treasure and boyfriends. And their captain? Why, the brave Amanda de Buscher, to be sure, for once upon a time, had not yonder sailing ship been Amanda's happiest fantasy? Once upon a time, before she had become so outwardly angry and so inwardly afraid? "Be quiet. We want to watch the hollyhocks." "Oh, Amanda," Lisi thought, almost mourned. This was the pool where we all came down to drink, the very cup of imagination, and so, of course, everyone saw it a little bit differently. This childhood refuge was Amanda's version. The benches were the same, however, which led Lisi to surmise that they, at least, were bedrock reality. Today she saw 20 or 30 people sitting on them, looking dreamily out at the water, and roughly the same number of shrouded forms.
In daylight, these latter bore a sickening resemblance to insects wrapped in silk by great spiders. She quickly spied Amanda, a dozen or so benches up. Lisi skirted two of the silent gazers and one of the scary shrouded things in order to reach her. She sat down beside her and once more took Amanda's hands, which weren't cut or even scarred over here. And, as Lisi held them, Amanda's fingers closed very slowly but definitely upon hers. A queer certainty came to Lisi then. Amanda didn't need the other sip from the pool Lisi had taken, nor did she need Lisi to coax her down to the water for a healing dip. Amanda did indeed want to come home. A large part of her had been waiting to be rescued, like a sleeping princess in a fairy tale, or a brave pirate girl cast into Durance Vile. And how many of these other unshrouded ones might be in the same situation? Lisi saw their outwardly calm faces and distant eyes, but that didn't mean some of them weren't screaming on the inside for someone to help them find their way back home. Lisi, who could only help her sister, maybe, shuddered away from this idea. "Amanda," she said, "we're going back now, but you have to help." Nothing at first, then very faint, very low, as if spoken out of sleep. "Lisi, did you drink that shitty punch?" Lisi laughed in spite of herself. "A little, to be polite. Now look at me." "I can't. I'm watching the Hollyhocks. I'm going to be a pirate and sail." Her voice was fading now. "The seven seas. Treasure. The Cannibal Isles." "That was make-believe," Lisi said. She hated the harshness she heard in her own voice. It was a little like drawing a sword to kill an infant that lay placidly on the grass, hurting no one. Because wasn't that what a childhood dream was like? "What you see is just this place's way of catching you. It's just a bool." Surprising her and hurting her, Manda said,
"Scott told me you'd try to come. That if I ever needed you, you'd try to come."
"When, Manda? When did he tell you that?"
"He loved it here," Amanda said, and fetched a deep sigh. "He called it Bulya Mood or something like that. He said it was easy to love, too easy."
"When, Manda? When did he say that?" Lisi wanted to shake her. Amanda appeared to make a tremendous effort and smiled.
"The last time I cut myself. Scott made me come home. He said, you all wanted me."
Now so much seemed clear to Lisi. Too late to make any difference, of course, but it was still better to know. And why had he never told his wife? Because he knew that little Lisi was terrified of Bulya Moon and the things, one thing in particular, that lived here? Yes. Because he sensed she would find out in time for herself? Again, yes. Amanda had once more turned her attention to the ship floating in the harbor that was her version of Scott's pool. Lisi shook her shoulder. "I need you to help me, Amanda. There's a lunatic who wants to hurt me, and I need you to help me put a spoke in his wheel. I need you to help me now." Amanda turned to look at Lisi with an almost comical expression of wonder on her face. Below them, a woman wearing a caftan and holding a snapshot of a smiling, gap-toothed child in one hand, looked back and spoke in slow, drifting remonstrance.
"Be quiet while I think of why I did it."
"Mind your beeswax, Betty," Lisi told her briskly, and then turned back to Amanda. She was relieved to see Amanda was still looking at her.
"Lisi, who?"
"A crazy man, one who showed up because of Scott's damned papers and manuscripts. Only now what he's interested in is me. He hurt me this morning, and he'll hurt me again if we don't. Amanda was turning once more toward the ship riding at anchor in the harbor, and Lisi took her head firmly in her hands so they were looking at each other again.
Pay attention, Beanpole.
Don't call me Bean.
Pay attention and I won't.
You know my car? My BMW?
Yes, but Lisey...
Amanda's eyes were still trying to drift back toward the water. Lisey almost turned her head back again, but some instinct told her that was a quick fix at best. If she really meant to get Amanda out of here, she had to do it with her voice, with her will, and ultimately because Amanda wanted to come.
Amanda, this guy. Never mind just hurting. If you don't help me, I think there's a chance he might kill me.
Now Amanda looked at her with amazement and perplexity.
Kill?
Yes, yes. I promise I'll explain everything, but not here. If we stay here long, I'll end up doing nothing but gawking at the hollyhocks with you.
Nor did she think this was a lie. She could feel the pull of the thing, how it wanted her to look. If she gave in, 20 years might pass like 20 minutes. At the end of them, she and Big Sis Amanda Bunny would still be sitting here, waiting to board a pirate ship that always beckoned but never sailed.
Will I have to drink any of that shitty punch? Any of that...
Amanda's brow furrowed as she struggled for memory, then the lines smoothed out.
Any of that bug juice?
The childish way she drew out the word surprised Lisey into another laugh, and once more the woman wearing the caftan and holding the photograph looked around. Amanda gladdened Lisey's heart by giving the woman a haughty, "Who you looking at, bitch?" stare, and then flipping her the bird.
Will I, little Lisey?
No more punch, no more bug juice, I promise. For now, you just think of my car. Do you know the color? Are you sure you remember?
Cream.
Amanda's lips thinned a little, and her look took on its just-a-little-home-truth-whenever-you-like-it-or-not expression. Lisey was absolutely delighted to see it.
I told you when you bought it that no color shows the dirt quicker, but you wouldn't listen.
Do you remember the bumper sticker?
A joke about Jesus, I think. Sooner or later, some pissed-off Christian is going to key it off, and probably put a few scratches in your finish for good luck.
From above them came a man's voice, heavily disapproving.
If you need to talk, you should go. Somewhere else.
Lisey didn't even bother turning around, let alone shooting him at the bird.
The sticker says, Jesus loves me, this I know, that is why I don't drive slow.
I want you to close your eyes now, Amanda, and see my car. See it from the back, so the bumper sticker's showing. See it in the shade of a tree. The shade's moving because it's breezy. Can you do that?
Yes, I think so.
Her eyes cut sideways, taking one final longing glance at the ship in the harbor.
I guess so, if it will keep someone from hurting you. Although I don't see what it can have to do with Scott. He's been dead over 2 years now. Although, I think he told me something about Good Ma's yellow Afghan, and I think he wanted me to tell you. Of course, I never did. I forgot so much about those times. On purpose, I suppose.
What times? What times, Amanda?
Amanda looked at Lisey as though her baby sister were the stupidest thing going.
All the times I cut myself. After the last time, when I cut my belly button, we were here.
Amanda put a finger to her cheek, creating a temporary dimple.
It was something about a story. Your story. Lisey's story. And the Afghan. Only he called it the African. Did he say it was a boop? A beep? A boon? Maybe I only dreamed it.
This, coming so unexpectedly out of left field, jolted Lisey but did not derail her. If she was going to get Amanda out of here, and herself, it had to be now. Never mind all that, Amanda. Just close your eyes and see my car. Every damn detail you can manage. I'll do the rest. I hope, she thought. And when she saw Amanda close her eyes, she did the same and gripped her sister's hands tightly. Now she knew why she'd needed to see her car so clearly, so they could return to the visitor's parking lot, rather than to Amanda's room in what was your basic locked ward. She saw her cream BMW, and Amanda was right, that color had been a disaster, then left that part to her sister. She concentrated on adding 5761RD to the license plate, and the piece de resistance, that Nordic Wolf beer bottle, standing on the asphalt just